Support for this Public Radio International program comes from the Humankind Program Fund, this station and PRI stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
I think it's the mission. It is the purpose. It is the longing. It is the hopes and dreams of our people today, and our forefathers and our foremothers, to build a sense of national community, but also to build and be part of the world community. But no one is left out or left behind.
When ordinary citizens join together and take a stand, they sometimes find that their voices count. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. An old saying goes that bad officials are elected by good citizens who don't vote. But low turnout on Election Day is just one symptom of dwindling public participation in America's civic life. Americans are often underinformed on issues of critical importance. Most people care about their community, but many feel powerless, the opposite of democracy. And it's a trend that worries John Bogle, who served as longtime chair of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
All of us have a huge obligation to spend at least a moment, probably every day, on thinking, what can I do to make this country work better? What can I do to repay the incredible advantages I have to being born here or being a naturalized citizen, or even for that matter, by being an immigrant that hopes to become a citizen?
And I ask you to repeat after me. I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state or sovereignty.
A naturalization ceremony in Seattle, Washington, where immigrants to America become U.S. citizens. It's often the new arrivals who develop a special appreciation for the amazing freedoms of belief and speech, of due process in court, of the right to elect our government, that native-born Americans so easily take for granted.
I'm pleased to declare that each of you is now a citizen of the United States of America.
True engagement by citizens begins with recognizing that neighbors in a community are ultimately bound together. It's what Paul Loeb in Seattle calls the soul of a citizen. It's the title of one of his books chronicling the power of individuals in a democracy to come together and make a difference.
There's a wonderful woman named Virginia Ramirez who dropped out. She lives in San Antonio and dropped out of school after an eighth grade education, got married, got pregnant, lived. I guess you'd call it a sort of try to live a good private life. And her husband raised their kids and with her and barely survived and wasn't involved in the community very much until an old woman in her neighborhood died of the cold, and essentially, her house was so run down that she would get sicker and sicker and eventually died. And Virginia was just outraged by this, had actually tried to get some help for the woman, and went to a local of a community group and said, "What are you going to do about it?" And they asked her what she was going to do, and she didn't know what to do, so she left. And a volunteer came knocking on her door a short while later and asked her why she was so upset. And she talked about the old woman and the life she'd lived working so hard and just left behind by our society. And then she started talking about her father as a migrant farm worker and everything that he faced and the underfunded schools in the community. And she said, nobody cares about our community. No one cares about us. And the volunteer from the organization said, "Well, do you think your neighbors care?" And she said, "Maybe, but who would listen to us?" And very hesitantly agreed to hold a house meeting. And the day comes, and she's absolutely terrified. Her stomach is clenching, her knees are knocking. She literally is standing, people are knocking on the door for about 5 minutes, unable to open the door because she's so afraid that she may say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. There's a phrase I use called the perfect standard about the notion that you need to know absolutely every answer to every possible question before you ever take a stand. And that's just slamming down on her like a hammer. And so what happens is she finally, of course, does open the door and they start talking and they like the process. It's a process of making private ills into public concerns. So all of them were worried about jobs. All of them were worried about their kids. All of them were worried about there were flash floods and kids would drown and underfunded schools. So lots and lots of things. And so she gradually steps into it and agrees to hold another House meeting, looks forward to it, but still faces setbacks. At one point, there was a first time she ever went to a city council meeting. She was testifying. She said, "I went blank. Forgot my speech, forgot my name, forgot everything." And then looks around with the people that she come with and remembers the story she has to tell and tells it. And what's interesting is a dozen years later, she's standing in Washington, D.C., and she's testifying before a committee of the United States Senate and the United States Congress. And I asked her, well, weren't you, it was on a job training bill, I said, weren't you completely nervous? I mean, this is, you know, U.S. senator is pretty intimidating. She said, well, I did pray to God I wouldn't make a complete fool of myself the night before, but to be honest, I was so much more afraid talking to my neighbors the first time. I was so much more afraid talking to the San Antonio City Council the first time. By the time I got to the U.S. Senate, I was used to it. So what I like is, I guess what's exemplary to her about Virginia Ramirez is the distance traveled.
Were there policies enacted? Were there changes as a result of her taking that stand?
There actually were, as a result of, again, not just her action, but the common action that she was part of, one of the things that occurred is that the poorest barrios of San Antonio saw about $2 billion of public and private investment come into them over a period of about 15 years. So all of a sudden, and they're still poor, but I remember her driving me around and just pointing out, here's the new high school, here's the business incubator, here's the youth center so the kids don't have to hang out on the streets. And she said it's still a very poor neighborhood, but look, but we have pride. People are taking, you know, they have the resources to take care of the homes now, and this neighborhood has hope.
From parent-teacher organizations to congregation-based efforts assisting the poor to voter registration drives, active citizens find numerous ways to contribute to the well-being of the communities they live in. Frances Moore LaPay in Boston is author of Diet for a Small Planet, Democracy's Edge, and recently Getting a Grip.
I think that there is a life impulse in each of us for meaning, for a sense that my life counts, and also very deeply a need to be good ancestors, you know, to pass on something to our children. And one of the greatest sources of despair is the sense that, oh my gosh, we are going to pass on to our children and grandchildren a world that is worse than we inherited. And that is heartbreaking and horrifying to most people. So there's tremendous motivation starting, as I say, with that need for meaning in our lives. And I think that thin democracy, which tells us all we have to do is shop and vote, can't meet that need for meaning and purpose. And so to me, that is the great motivator that I see in the faces of people who I know who are powerfully engaged.
And Frances Moore LaPay feels we often misunderstand the large population of Americans who are disengaged, people who seem to be too distracted or too cynical to contribute.
I really think that apathy, what we typically call apathy, is despair or just a heartbreak of feeling hopeless, which are deep feelings. So it's not a not caring. You care, but it hurts too much to express it because you feel hopeless. And similarly with cynicism, I think that is a symptom of this deeper sense of loss, and people don't know what to do with that loss. They are grieving the loss of their own feeling that they have a voice in a real democracy. And so what my life is about, in one could say, is helping people see possibility for re-engagement that is real. And by telling stories of empowerment where, just to pick an example, there are now 3 million Americans who are engaged through their congregations in what are called faith-based community organizing networks, the largest being the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was begun in Chicago. And the one now here where I live in Boston, the Greater Boston Interfaith, is an organization, multicultural, multi-class, that has been very much involved in shaping the healthcare reform here in our state. So these are people who are directly engaged out of their values and directly shaping public policy on everything from living wage campaigns, which have been successful now in so many parts of the country and helped to shape this recent victory to lift the minimum wage. These are people who are never been involved in public life before, many of them low-income people, and are finding their voices and taking it to the next stage of what I love to call the arts of democracy. That I often, I'm aware that we are deeply social creatures, we human beings, but we're not born knowing how to do democracy well. You know, this is an art that we have to learn, like dribbling a basketball or playing the piano. And in these particular organizations I'm mentioning now, another key one is ACORN, which has hundreds of thousands of low-income people across almost 900 communities in this country, and they do trainings. So it's not just expecting people to know how to get in there and represent their values and their interest in public life, but they are trained in what is power and how can I be effective.
So many low-income and poor people have this feeling that my one vote will not count, that it will not make a difference.
Congressman John Lewis of Georgia.
And I think after the last two national elections, it's this sense that, well, we won, but somehow we lost. So it created a greater degree of cynicism. More and more people drop out. When people go to the poll to attempt to vote in Florida or in Georgia or in Ohio or some other place, they are told that you cannot vote. Your name is not on the record. You're a felony. And you've never been arrested. You've never been in jail. So that creates this sense, why bother? And then this feeling that on the part of some low-income people, poor people, that I've been down so long until down don't get me down. They just give up. They drop out. And there is a need for a mightier, a powerful movement to set to low-income people, to poor people, to those with the least, that your one vote is just as powerful and as significant as the vote of the richest human being, or the richest citizen of America.
You're listening to a Humankind special, a union of citizens. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, Part 2, visit our website, humanmedia.org. It is an undeniable fact of our democracy that the least wealthy Americans also tend to vote in the lowest numbers. To have any sector of society opting out of the system can't help but warp our democratic process, whose very foundation is a level playing field for all citizens. Historian and author Kevin Phillips.
The people who don't vote, it's younger people, poorer people, and people who just have to work too hard, even if they're keeping their head above water, to be able to do that. And that would be, for example, a single mother with a couple of kids, and maybe the income is enough above the poverty line that they're not in trouble that way, but they're in trouble because it's very hard for her, and sometimes it could be a him, to do all these things, to be able to take care of the children and do the whole handling of the household at the same time as he or she holds down a job.
And you're saying the person is simply too busy on election day?
Yes, because they build their life around all the things they have to do. and they don't put that high a premium on politics. They probably don't pay too much attention to political news and so forth. So that's another group that's conspicuous, younger women, even if single mothers who have a couple of kids, do not vote in very large numbers.
And why do these various populations, the poor, the young, the people who are struggling to make ends meet, not prioritize political engagement as a way to help their plight?
Well, here I guess I may reflect a little bit of my Republican antecedents, but I think the Republicans can motivate these people to go to the polls if it's a cultural issue or a patriotic issue. But they don't motivate them economically because they basically get their support from the people, the small percent that have the great interest in upper bracket economics. It's the Democrats who have to speak to these people. But in the era of money determining politics, they don't want to offend their contributors by saying anything that's too incendiary. It's not cool to do that if you have to raise your money from the people in the top 1 or 2%.
Look into the soul of the society and see when we stand back what we really have here.
John Bogle, founder of the $1.2 trillion investment firm Vanguard, is author of The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism.
I mean, I look at, for example, and a lot of people disagree with me greatly on this, particularly people in my kind of level of, I don't know, wealth, for the want of a better word. And that is, I find the gap between the highest 1% or even a tenth of 1% of our citizens and the bottom 15% or 20% to be quite stunning and growing, back as it was in the age of the robber barons.
What impact does this growing income inequality have upon our democratic society?
Participation, for example, we know this to be the case. Participation in voting, we know absolutely, rises as wealth rises, not in the same scale upward, but participation definitely rises with wealth and education. And, you know, I'd argue from the democratic standpoint that at least as far as education, because that's a good thing. You know, if we had a huge participation by the uneducated, I'm not sure we'd have a very good country. If the wealthy dropped out of the political system, and basically as our founding fathers were worried about, the mob, I think they used the expression, the mob rules. They didn't want that. That's why we have this system of elected representatives. That's why we have a republic and not a pure democracy.
But on the other side of the coin, what is the impact on our democracy of lack of participation by people who are the most disadvantaged, who are in effect suffering the most from this inequality of income?
Well, they don't have a chance, a fighting chance, to get the fair treatment that we really owe it to them to give them. We cannot, you know, no matter what wealth level, even at the very highest levels, we cannot afford to have a society with all these uneducated citizens. It's terrible for business in the long run. You know, education is more important than it's ever been. You know, it's one thing in the old days of an agricultural economy. You'd need an awful lot of education. You had to know a lot, have a lot of wisdom to know how to, you know, rotate crops and farm. But we've gone from an agricultural economy to a manufacturing economy to a service economy, and now really to a financial economy. And the people at the top of the financial economy ought to be worried. If the benefits of this society are going to such a narrow number of people. These are consumers out there. They're going to buy what they have to sell, and they're going to be very dissatisfied. And we aren't in a situation here in this country where we're going to be looking at riots. I don't think we've had them in the past in some of the cities, New York, Los Angeles. But a society where there's that kind of a gap between the top tier, the very top tier, and the bottom is going to be an unstable society, which is going to hurt the top tier.
To have in America, to have in our democracy, such unbelievable disparity is a threat to our sense of peace, and to our sense of order, to our sense of equality.
Congressman John Lewis, Democrat of Georgia.
If you have and continue to have this disparity when it comes to income, health, education, I think in years to come, it spell real trouble for America.
Do you foresee that it could lead to unrest?
It is my feeling that if we do not do something and do it in a hurry to close the gap between the haves and the have-not, we will be creating a situation that can bring down the curtains on the American dream.
This is the National Constitution Center, established by an act of Congress and opened in 2003 to an estimated 1 million visitors per year. It is housed on Independence Mall in Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776, and where the U.S. Constitution was written in 1787.
The multimedia presentation was very emotional. Very gratifying being a citizen of the United States. I felt very proud after watching the presentation.
Wow, what gave you that pride?
Watching the challenges that this country has overcome, from declaring independence to abolishing slavery to on to the civil rights movement.
Guests of the museum hear the biographies of historic Americans, assume the seat of a Supreme Court justice, take the presidential oath of office, a favorite of school children, and learn major themes of the Constitution.
What part of America's democracy is most important to you?
Freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of being able to determine your own destiny.
What does it mean for you, determining your own destiny?
Well, that we're able to look at things and weigh them and decide how it is that we should be able to go.
The most important thing, I guess, would be the freedoms and the rights that we have here in America that we don't have anywhere else, and the, I guess, obligation that we have to protect those freedoms and to teach our children the enormous responsibility of being an American citizen.
The enormous responsibility of being an American citizen, what for you does that mean?
Being loyal to your country, being patriotic, following the laws and the guidelines, making sure that you can promote Americanism.
And how do you define loyalty to our country?
Fly the American flag, support our troops, support our congressmen and our governors, be there for the state representatives to vote, and voice your opinion peacefully.
Do you think it's consistent with being patriotic and American to oppose the policies of the government?
Oh, I think you can be patriotic and disagree with people who are in power. I think that's part of your obligation as well, is to make sure that they understand how you do feel so that you are your opinion does get heard.
The most important part for me, it says it's for the people. And unfortunately, it had to have amendments to make sure it was for all the people.
I guess the whole Bill of Rights was kind of tacked on as an afterthought.
And I often think of Abigail Adams, who said to her husband, "Don't forget the ladies," and they left it out. but I really feel it was a long struggle for us, and it should not have been. But that's most important. The 19th Amendment is the most important to me and my granddaughters.
And your granddaughter.
Yes.
An autocratic system like the monarchy that was overthrown by America's founders during the Revolution works from the top down. A democratic society, at least in theory, works from the grassroots up. Large social movements might start at someone's kitchen table or in a municipal town hall or among friends chatting in the stands of a Little League game. Bottom up is the fundamental direction of democracy. John Bogle.
Our local elected officials are really responsive to the voice of the citizenry. It works pretty well at a local level. When you get things like global warming, you know, how many people are going to go out and buy more gas-efficient, energy-efficient cars? Not enough. In a lot of ways, quoting Pogo, I think here, we have met the enemy and they are us.
Doesn't it, though, take concerted national policy and courage to say, we've got to make some changes?
Well, you're basically talking about, I think, one of the main problems of American society today. and that is we are a very selfish society. Yes, I want all this, but I don't want to give up my SUV. I want that. It's my right to have it. It's a free country. No reason I should cut back on my until we finally get higher gas taxes. No reason I should be thinking about whether it's good for me and bad for everybody else. We have a society with, as has been said about the Roman Empire, it collapsed because of self-love. And Roman society was sitting on top of the world, protected by its armies, greater wealth, greater power than any nation in the history of mankind. And no empire, and we have an empire here in America, can take its greatness for granted. No empire has ever survived permanently. A lot of change in life. And if we could just awaken the citizens to say to the fact that, you know, we're not doomed to be like the Roman Empire, although if we continue on our present course, I think we are doomed to be like the Roman Empire. We have to change a lot of things in the way we look at our society, a lot of things in our economic system, a lot of things in our financial system, a lot of things in our governmental system. But otherwise, this society is going to get a little bit worse all the time. And there's quite a bit of evidence that that's happening. Even as we see wealth piled on wealth piled on wealth, we continue to grow. And it's required that we look at ourselves. And it's a very hard thing to accomplish as long as we are self-satisfied with where we are today.
Look at ourselves?
Yeah, introspection.
What would our country look like if Americans were able to express and had the courage to express that deep caring that we have?
Francis Moore LaPay.
And for me, then, it would be a living practice of democracy. Democracy is a way of life that is not a set system that we inherit, but a set of system values and qualities that we infuse across our purchases in the marketplace, our workplace choices, how we educate our children, how we say hello to our neighbors on a daily basis, how we include everyone in decision making, how we consciously send a message to one another of possibility rather than despair. So it's a culture of not just caring for one another, but co-creating with one another. And it is assuming not the goodness of human nature as if we are all good, but tapping the best of us, which is our need for cooperation, fairness, and power in expressing our values.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Kathy Graham. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
We're distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, part two of A Union of Citizens, is Humankind program number 118.
PRI, Public Radio International.